This is the story of Pugh and Martin, two men who, after producing only five musicals, had every other Broadway producer thirsting for their blood. Why? Because all five musicals were huge successes. Considering how difficult it is to put on a show, it's hard enough to come up with one hit in a row, let alone five. And they were big hits, too, featuring such songs as these.
I've never been in love before. Now all at once it's you. It's you forevermore.
I love the looks of you, the lure of you. I'd love to make quite sure of you. The eyes, the arms, the mouth of you. The east, west, north, and the south of you.
I could be happy with you.
I'd be contented to live anywhere. What would I care? As long as you were there.
Dear, it's all right. It's all right with me.
Songs from shows produced by Cy Feuer and Ernest Martin. Two singularly single-minded men to whom flop is the dirtiest of all four-letter words. Since they first set up shop in 1947, they've created and produced 10 Broadway shows, only three of which have failed to earn a profit. As records go, this borders on science fiction. But to achieve so many successes, Feuer and Martin have had to fight with a lot of people and dispense with a lot of people. A director they sacked during a tryout tour once announced bitterly that when he died, he wanted to be cremated and have his ashes thrown in Ernest Martin's face.
There is a brotherhood of man, a benevolent brotherhood of man, a noble tie that binds all human hearts and minds into one brotherhood of man. Your lifelong membership is free. Keep a giving each brother all you can. Oh, aren't you proud to be in that fraternity, the great big brotherhood of man. So, Wally, before you consider firing everybody, remember this. One man may seem incompetent, another not make sense, while others look like quite a waste of company expense. They need a brother's leadership, so please don't do them in. Remember, mediocrity is not a mortal sin. They're
in
the you're proud to be in that fraternity, the great big brother of man.
No kidding. Is there really a brotherhood?
Yes, brother.
You
got me
in that
A song from How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, a Feuer and Martin hit of 1961. They first met 15 years earlier. At the time, Ernest Martin was a radio executive, anxious to try a new field before American broadcasting sank slowly in the West. Cy Feuer was writing and conducting background music for films. Remember Come On Rangers, Federal Manhunt, The Cyclone Kid? Not really surprising, they were all pretty obscure B-pictures. Cy Feuer explains how the lucky partnership started.
Well, Ernie was a friend of my brother's. We met through him. At the time, Ernie was director of programs for CBS, and I was working as a musical director for Republic Pictures. And in comparing notes, one of the things that was discussed was that we both had recently been to New York, I while I was in the Army, and he on a trip for CBS. And we had both of us visited the New York theater, particularly the musical theater, and thought that we were somewhat disappointed by what we had seen. We had great anticipation of seeing something quite wonderful, and actually we were somewhat disappointed, and this led to a further discussion of the theater. These are the very beginnings.
And who more appropriate to continue the story than Feuer and Martin's first star, the brilliant eccentric dancer who under their management had his best part since he played the unforgettable scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz, Ray Bolger.
One day I was in Sardi's restaurant. Sardi's restaurant is the restaurant where all the theatrical people go. And I ran into a man by the name of Ernie Martin. And I found him to be very, very bright and very eager. Eager to be in the business. Now this time, for our next show, we want to put on our own show, my wife Gwen. Because we thought that to get away from all the harassment of other people, if we're going to have harassment, let us have it in our own family, as it were. So we talked to Ernie Martin, and I say, he's a real bright fella. I talked it over with my wife, and we decided we'd have a talk with him. Then we found out that he had a partner, and they were anxious to be on Broadway, and that they had been running around and scouting around with Richard Rodgers and everybody and talking to everybody while he was working over at CBS, doing some menial job over there. And we decided that we would do a show.
Fascinated by her, set your heart afire to stay. Once you're kissed by Amy, tear up your list, it's Amy. Ply her with bonbons, poetry and flowers, moon a million hours away. You might be quite the fickle-hearted rover, so carefree and bold. Who loves a girl and later thinks it over, then just quit cold. All at once in love with Amy. Always in love with Amy. Ever and ever, sweetly you'll romance her. Trouble is, the answer will be that Amy'd rather stay in love with me.
The show which Bolger, Feuer, and Martin decided to do turned out to be Where's Charlie? A musical version of that war horse of war horses, Charlie's Aunt. There were a lot of good reasons why this show should have been a failure. Frank Lesser, who wrote the music and lyrics, had never done a stage musical before, and neither had Feuer and Martin. In fact, Where's Charlie was only the fourth stage musical that Ernest Martin had ever seen. But the show was well received and settled down for a 2-year run. Once in Love with Amy always went well enough, but during the very first Broadway matinee, something altogether magic happened. Cy Feuer begins the story.
Well, it has to do with my younger son, who at the time was about 7 years old. And he knew Ray, because Ray was up at the house quite a bit. And he also knew all of the music that Frank Lesser had written, because we had demos made. and we would play them very often. And Ray would be around very often, and he was familiar with the music and Ray. And one matinee, early in the run, we got him two seats down front. He was taking a friend of his. He could, you know, kids can see this show repeatedly. You know, walk him into the theater, and they'll look at it any number of times. At any rate, on this day, he had a friend, and we got him a pair of seats down about the second or third row. And during that matinee, Ray came out and went blank on the lyrics of Amy. To recover from this, he made a joke out of it, and he kind of addressed the audience and said, how does it go, or something to that effect. At any rate, Bobby stood up in the third row and told him. Now, he didn't know it was Bobby. He thought it was some kid. And he said, well, would you like to sing it with me? And Bobby said, sure. And they started to sing it together, and then he had to get himself out of this, because he lost the audience to the kid. And to get it back, he tried to get everybody to sing, and it was just a recovery at the time.
Now, I just looked out at that audience. And I said, once in love with Amy, always in love with Amy, ever, never fascinated by her, such a heart of fire to stay. Are you ready? And they sang it. First, they came in very furtively. Then all of a sudden, they begin to get a feel for it. And that number just built from what was about 6 minutes to 20 minutes.
So happy. I want everybody to sing with me the next line. Once you're kissed by Amy.
Once you're kissed by Amy.
Tear up your list, it's Amy.
Tear up your list, it's Amy.
Buy her with bonbons, poetry, and flowers.
Buy her with bonbons, poetry, and flowers.
Moon a million hours away.
Moon a million hours away.
Let me say it.
You might be quite the fickle-hearted rover, so carefree and bold, who loves the girl and later thinks it over, then just quits cold.
Everybody sing Once in Love with Amy.
Once in love with Amy.
Always in love with Amy.
Years later, Fuhrer and Martin presented their masterpiece, a brilliant musical based on the stories of Damon Runyon. Frank Lesser was hired again to write the songs, and Abe Burrows wrote the libretto, after 11 other writers had bitten the dust. Says Ernest Martin,
I think that we probably got more pleasure out of Guys and Dolls. We were younger. It was our second show. Our first show, Where's Charlie, had been a success, but it was a struggling success. And Guys and Dolls was one of those magic things. It was sort of a hit before it was ever put on the stage.
For the people all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. People all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. I sailed away on that little boat to heaven, and by some chance found a bottle in my fist, and there I stood nicely passing out the whiskey, but the passengers were bound to resist. For the people all said, beware, you're on a heavenly trip. People all said, beware, beware you scuttle a ship, and the devil will drag you under by the fancy tie round your wicked throat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And as I laughed at those passengers to heaven, a great big wave came and washed me overboard. And as I sank and I hollered, someone save me, that's the moment I woke up. Thank the Lord. And I said to myself, sit down, you're rocking a boat. Said to myself, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under with a soul so heavy you'd never float. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
Sit down, you're rocking, sit down, sit down.
To guide their various guys and dolls around the stage, Feuer and Martin hired the vastly experienced man of the theatre, George S. Kaufman, as their director. A persistent Broadway legend concerns the rehearsals of Guys and Dolls. Kaufman was set upon by the volatile Frank Lesser, who felt that such first-act songs as I'll Know and If I Were a Bell wouldn't register because Kaufman wouldn't allow them to be reprised in the second act. Lesser shouted about it for some time until the director finally said, "Look, Frank, I'll make a deal with you. You can reprise the songs in the second act if I can reprise some of the jokes."
Ask me how do I feel. Ask me now that we're cozy and clinging. Well, sir, all I can say is if I were a bell, I'd be ringing. From the moment we kissed tonight, that's the way I've just got to behave. Boy, if I were a lamp, I'd light. And if I were a banner, I'd wave. Ask me, how do I feel? Little me with my quiet upbringing. Well, sir, all I can say is if I were a gate, I'd be swinging. If I were a watch, I'd start popping my spring. Or if I were a bell, I'd go ding dong, ding dong, ding.
The noted composer Arthur Schwartz told us another much-repeated Guys and Dolls story. Scene, New York, time, just after the final run-through before the show left for its Philadelphia tryout.
Kaufman, who was always conservative and always underplayed the possibility of success, was speaking with Feuer as the run-through finished, which was an excited experience for both of them and for the audience that they had, the few people. And Feuer said to Kaufman, "George, you know, I don't understand. People say when you go to Philadelphia, there's always trouble in Philadelphia. Now, why should a show like this, which we've just seen, why should it have trouble in Philadelphia? I ask you." Kaufman said, "Well, there's one thing, Si, that you don't know about Philadelphia. The first Tuesday of every month, and that's the day we're going to travel, the Pennsylvania Railroad shuts off all passenger traffic and all freight traffic from New York to Philadelphia. And on that day, all they take to Philadelphia is trouble, so when you get there, it'll be there."
But it wasn't. The Philadelphia opening was a triumph, and as for the Broadway first night, well, the critics came up with all the superlatives they knew. One of them, John Chapman of the New York Daily News, called Guys and Dolls the best musical of the year because of its originality and its avoidance of the usual musical comedy patterns. Then there was the New York Times.
I think Brooks Atkinson called it an American folk opera and so on. And we thought it had some social content in perhaps being a funny analysis of the morality and the ethics, especially regarding men and women, of sort of the gangster credo that later was done rather seriously in The Godfather and so on. The relationship between men and women and Guys and Dolls was, a caricature of that kind of thing.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can't bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane. There's only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten a Taj Mahal. Call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some dough. When you see a Joe saving half of his dough, you can bet they'll be minking it for some dough. When a bum buys wine like a bum can't afford, it's a cinch that the bum is under the thumb of some little broad. When you meet a mug lately out of the jug, and he's still lifting platinum Fal-de-Ral, call it hell, call it heaven, it's a probable 12 to 7 that the guy's only doing it for some dough.
When you see a sport and his cash has run short, you can bet that he's banking it with some doll.
When a guy wears tails with the front gleaming white, who the hell do you think he's tickling pink on Saturday night?
When a lazy slob takes a good steady job and he smells from Vitalis and Barbasol.
Call it dumb, call it clever, oh, but you can give odds forever that the guy's only doing it for some doll, some doll, some doll. The guy's only doing it for some doll.
Guys and Dolls was tough to follow, but Feuer and Martin aren't easily daunted. For their next show, they turn to another one-man words and music team, the incomparable Cole Porter. Porter had just had a resounding flop, and the word along Broadway was that his previous hit, Kiss Me Kate, was nothing but a fluke. In fact, the recording executive, Mitch Miller, after hearing an audition of the Can-Can score, stated firmly that the songs had no future whatsoever. That judgment included It's All Right With Me, which we played earlier, and this song.
I love Paris in the springtime. I love Paris in the fall. I love Paris in the winter when it drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles. I love drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles.
A song which Cole Porter wrote after seeing a backdrop designed by Joe Mielsner showing a truly Parisian skyline. Can-Can was the show in which the sexy red-headed dancer Gwen Verdon made her name. Mind you, it wasn't her name until the decisive Feuer and Martin went to work.
I was the last one billed. In fact, my full name is Gwyneth, and it didn't fit. It didn't balance out with all the names. So they just cut off the ith part and made it Gwyn. And I was not even asked about that. I don't think I would have accepted a job from them had they come along with a stunning part, because they did come along with extraordinary billing, being, you know, third or fourth above the title, which I refused. I wanted more money instead.
Never mind. The newly christened Gwen Verdon was an overnight sensation, even though her role had been slashed and re-slashed so as not to lessen the impact of the show's star, the French singer Lilo. Feuer and Martin's next production looked like an easy one. They saw the Sandy Wilson show, The Boyfriend, in London, pronounced it perfect, and bought it for Broadway, vowing they wouldn't change a thing. Later in America, however, they've demanded alterations. Because Sandy Wilson objected, the next time he entered the theatre for rehearsal, two of Feuer and Martin's heftier assistants picked the astonished author up, carried him outside, and dumped him on the pavement. One of the changes the producers made was to augment the orchestra. Obviously a good move, because on the first night, the overture received such an ovation that the curtain couldn't rise. Only a few days earlier, the leading lady of the boyfriend had been a candidate for Fuhr and Martin's axe. They thought the actress, a young fugitive from English Panto and educating Archie named Julie Andrews, was playing the virginal Polly Brown in too tongue-in-cheek a manner. But she gave the duo the performance they wanted after Cy Fuhr had told her, "Don't laugh at Polly, be her." Her wide-eyed sincerity made her, as the saying goes, an overnight star.
All we want is a room, he proves the ring. Just a room that will do for you and me. I'll sew the covers for two old cozy armchairs. Neighbors will love us for, we shall laugh at all our cares.
While I'm reading a book,
I'll cook a stew. Then I'll bake a plum duck, enough for two.
In our attic, we'll be ecstatic as lovebirds up in a tree. All we want is our room in Bloomsbury.
Julie Andrews in the hit show that led to a role in an even bigger hit, the role of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady. Fuhr and Martin turned again to Cole Porter for their next show, a musical version of the Garbo film Ninotchka. They called it Silk Stockings, and its slow and stormy progress to Broadway was fraught, as Ernie and Cy recall, with every known kind of disaster.
We one time had the understudy for an understudy ill, and we had to just impress a girl from the chorus into playing a role who had never done it before. We made extensive changes in the book. We changed book writers. We changed directors. We started out with a book by George Kaufman and Louine McGraw, followed through by A. Burroughs. Cy, my partner, replaced George Kaufman as director of the show, and so on. It was just one of those shows that didn't seem to go right. Despite the fact that Noel Coward came and saw, in fact, Noel Coward causes a great deal of problem because he came and saw the first performance in Philadelphia and went backstage and told the Kaufmans that the show was just marvelous, no change a thing. And it took us 3 or 4 days of cold audience to convince them that Noel was either mistaken or just being friendly.
Also, the second lead developed phlebitis while we were on the road, had to be operated on. We were out of town so long that she recovered from the operation and came back into the show. And her understudy, for some reason, took off one night. She just waited for the curtain to go up while this woman was suffering prior to the operation. And we discovered that after the curtain went up, she used to go to New York from Philadelphia. So that if anything happened during the show, we weren't covered. And then we had to replace her, and it was terribly complicated. Nothing worked. We were out for 13 weeks trying to fix it.
It was towards the end of those 13 weeks, with the cast exhausted from months of travel, that their director, Abe Burroughs, said to them, "I don't want to worry anybody, but I just saw Ernie Martin looking at a globe." An equally weary Cole Porter found enough energy during the tryout tour to write 6 new songs, and this was one of them.
Today, to get the public to attend the picture show, it's not enough to advertise a famous star they know. If you want to get the crowds to come around, you gotta have glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and stereophonic sound. If Zanuck's latest picture were the good old-fashioned kind, there'd be no one in front to look at Marilyn's behind. If you want to hear applauding hands resound, you gotta have glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and stereophonic sound. The customers don't like to see the groom embrace the bride unless her lips are scarlet and her bosom's 5 feet wide. In glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, or Cinerama, VistaVision, SuperScope, or Tadeo, and stereophonic sound, and stereophonic sound. You all remember Lassie, that beloved canine star. To see her wag her tail, the crowds would come from near and far. But at present, she'd be just another hound unless she had glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and stereophonic sound. I lately did a picture picture at the bottom of the sea. I wrestled with an octopus and licked an anchovy, but the people wouldn't care if I had drowned unless I had glorious technicolor, breathtaking cinemascope and stereo.
Finally, after untold agonies, Silk Stockings opened in New York, where it happily remained for a respectable run of 477 performances. It was at this point in their joint career that Feuer and Martin made two mistakes. They turned down a show called The Music Man, and even worse, they didn't turn down a show called Whoop Up. This was it, their long-awaited first flop. Cause for rejoicing among rival producers, especially as Ernie and Cy had worked on the libretto of the show. Are they likely to do such a thing again?
Oh, I don't think so. It was a failure. It was our biggest failure.
We're not really writers. We thought we could do it because we had the thing all blocked out and eventually called in Dan Cushman, the writer of the original novel, to help us, which he did, but not enough.
After the dull thud of Whoop Up, there was a gap of 3 years before another Feuer and Martin show hit Broadway. And this time, Broadway didn't hit back. The firm had another big hit, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
I play it the company way. Wherever the company puts me, there I stay.
But what is your point of view?
I have no point of view.
Supposing the company thinks
I think so too.
Now, what would you say?
I wouldn't say.
Your face is a company face.
It smiles at executives, then goes back in place.
The company furniture.
Oh, it suits me fine.
The company letterhead.
A Valentine.
Anything you're against?
Unemployment.
Do you have any hobbies?
I've a hobby. I play gin with Mr. Bratton.
Mr. Bratton, do you play it nicely?
Play it nicely. Still, he blitzes me in every game like that.
Why?
Because I play it the company way.
Executive policy
is by me okay.
How can you get anywhere?
Junior, have no fear. Whoever the company fires, I will still be
you
here.
You will still be here.
Year after year after fiscal. Never take a risk, oh yeah.
How to Succeed dealt with the rapid rise of an awesomely ambitious young man named J. Pierpont Finch. For this role, the producers chose Robert Morse.
Cy came up to me and said, I have something for you. It's How to Succeed. Oh, I was very excited. Cy just loves the theater. He loves to run up and down the aisles, and he especially loves to correct things in the orchestra. But Frank Lesser would let him, I guess. I guess he played an instrument one time. Probably people speak of this, some saxophone or a trumpet, and if we can keep him busy there, we'll keep him out of our hair. He does love to run around and change things and do little things. You have to give him credit. He did believe in this show, and that was enough. I think he was in getting Bob Fosse to do this show. He was, you know, he had something to do with it.
You have the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet there's that upturned chin and that grin of impetuous youth. Oh, I believe in you. I believe in you. I hear the sound of good, solid judgment whenever you talk. Yet there's the bold, brave spring of the tiger that quickens your walk. I believe in you. I believe.
when my fate in my fellow man all but falls apart. I've but to feel your hand grasping mine, and I take heart. I take heart to see the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet with the slam, bang, tang, reminiscent of gin and vermouth, I believe in you. I believe in you.
Gotta stop that man. Gotta stop that man. For he'll stop me. Big wheel, big fever, boiling hot with front office fever. Gotta stop, gotta stop.
Oh, I believe in you.
Don't let him be such a hero.
I believe in you.
Robert Morse singing to his own reflection in the washroom mirror while his rivals, beautifully drilled by choreographer Bob Fosse, plot to stop him. When How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying closed, it became the sixth longest-running show in Broadway history. It also won a flock of impressive awards, including a Pulitzer Prize. Cy and Ernie followed it with another very funny musical, Little Me, in which the American comedian Sid Caesar played six parts. Carolyn Lee and another Cy, Cy Coleman, wrote the songs, one of which, Real Live Girl, caused a certain amount of trouble in rehearsal.
We had a number which, by all rights, should have been a showstopper at the end of the first act. It had cannons going off. It had Sid Caesar jumping up and down, telling jokes. It had girls running, choruses kicking. Everything was going on. We thought the song was kind of a good song. You've never seen anything greeted with such apathy. I mean, our show was steamrolling along, and we'd get to this number that should have been a blockbuster, and it was just a fizzle. And Bob Fosse said, well, let's go back to that song, Real Live Girl. Maybe we ought to slow down. And he tried it, and it worked, beautifully.
Pardon me, miss, but I've never done this with a real live girl. Straight off the farm with an actual armful of real live girls. Pardon me if your affectionate squeeze fogs up my glasses and buckles my knees. I'm simply drowned in the sight and the sound and the scent and the feel of a real live girl.
It ran, I think, a year, and then we toured it for perhaps a year. And it got marvelous reviews in England, and it didn't really have the run that we thought it would. Bruce Forsyth was it. But he got sick at one point. After, I think...
That's right. He got sick, and then it never recovered.
He was out
for 3 weeks, and that was the end of the show. Business dropped off while he was out. He got great notices. He was marvelous in it.
Pardon me if your affectionate nudge fogs up my glasses much worse than the fudge. I'm all in stitches from finding what riches a waltz can reveal with a real live girl.
Mm-hmm.
Feuer and Martin Musical No. 9 had music by Jimmy Van Heusen and lyrics by the irrepressible Sammy Kahn.
So we set about doing a musical called Skyscraper, and this was my first intimate association with Feuer and Martin. Now, I must tell you swiftly that when I'm asked what it is like to be involved in a Broadway musical, I always say it is the closest that a man comes to understanding full and complete childbirth. It is an all-consuming enterprise. And Jimmy Van Heusen and I started to write this score, and I must say honestly that Jimmy Van Heusen and I found the movie scene a little more casual. There wasn't this enormous, enormous pressure. And Cy Feuer, we found a terrifying taskmaster. But when we thought we'd written something rather worthwhile, he would dismiss it casually. And Jimmy Van Heusen and I had taken a kind of an oath saying that if and when we went to Broadway, we would play the rules according to the ballpark we were in. So whatever Cy Feuer and or Ernie Martin said, we would abide by. If Cy Feuer said, write that song backwards, we would write it backwards. If he said, write it upside down, we would write it upside down. We would not engage in any debate with him. We were not going to be the Hollywood wise guys coming to tell the Broadway men of their business. And so this was our rule. But there came a day, I remember it so well, in Jimmy Van Heusen's apartment on West 57th Street. We had written a song called Everybody Has the Right to Be Wrong. We were totally frustrated by the messes Feuer and Martin, mostly by Mr. Feuer. And we had made up our mind, if he, even by the slightest grimace or raising of an eyebrow, found fault with this song, we were going to say, well, thank you very much, Mr. Feuer. You have the wrong boys for this assignment. It's been fun and goodbye. But he must have sensed the radar or whatever, because when we finished the song, he said, it's marvelous. So we continued our project.
Everybody has the right to be wrong, at least once. Everybody has the right to be dunce, like once, like not being too smart is no disgrace. What sets you apart is smiling with egg on your face. It's naive to make believe that you're right. It's not right. Only fools go walking on thin ice. Twice you in life and skip the strife, and you'll both get along. All it takes is simply saying you're wrong when you're wrong, and everybody has the right to be. It can be a real delight to be. Everybody has the right to be.
Skyscraper's press notices were mixed and its run short. However, Kahn and Van Heusen were soon working with Feuer and Martin again, and the new show was Walking Happy, a musical based on Hobson's Choice, starring Norman Wisdom.
There's the kind of walk you walk when you feel like crowing. There's the kind of walk you walk when you're on your way. There's the kind of walk you walk when your pride is showing. And the kind of walk you walk when today's your day. There's the kind of walk you walk when the world's all rainbow and your heart's hopping like a popping jay. Good fortune's found you, chappy, and your life's a happy balance.
common world seem far.
Despite bright songs like that, Walking Happy, sad to say, was not a success. Particularly sad because it marked the last Broadway production to date by Feuer and Martin. Well, what have they been doing lately? Robert Morse didn't know either, and when he ran into Cy Feuer not long ago...
I said, Cy, gee, it's so good to see you after these many years. What have you been doing? He looked at me. I said, no, I mean, you're not in the theater anymore. You retired. I heard you have a home in East Hampton in the car, but I don't know what you're doing. He looked at me for a minute. He says, well, I've been busy. I said, well, you know. He said, well, I just produced the movie Cabaret. Well, I've got red, green, all colors of the American flag, the Union flag, the Jack, the name of red flag, the Russia. I went beat red. I felt like an idiot. But he says, don't. I get it all the time. People associate me with theater. You associate me with theater. And, you know, our names are produced by Cy Feuer and Ernie Martin Cabaret. Who would know? You think of Liza Minnelli. You think of Joel Grey. You think of Bob Fosse. So I felt a little better, but I felt awful because he was not a close friend, but a close associate. And it slipped my mind, you know, and I went, oh, how embarrassing. And then I said to him, oh, well, typical how to succeed in business. I said, maybe there's a part for me in your next movie, so.
Money. Money.
When you haven't any coal in your stove, and you freeze in the winter, and you curse to the bin that you face. When you haven't any shoes on your feet, your coat's thin as paper, and you look 30 pounds underweight. When you go to get a word of advice from the fat little pastor, he will tell you to love evermore. But when hunger comes to rap, rat a tat, rat a tat, at the window.
The window.
Who's there?
Hunger.
Oh, hunger.
See how love flies out the door.
Money makes a bird go round the bird, go round the bird. Money makes a bird go round the clinking, clanking sound.
Money, get a little money. Mark a yen, a buck, for a pound. That clinking, clanking, clumping sound is good. That makes a bird go round.
It makes a bird go round.
After Cabaret, Feuer and Martin made another film based on the life of Edith Piaf. And at the moment, they're the managing directors of the imposing-sounding Los Angeles and San Francisco Civic Light Opera Association. Even as I speak, Cy is probably running up the aisle to correct things in the orchestra, and Ernie is sacking somebody. Also currently, they're planning a musical about the French Foreign Legion. It's called Sand and has a score by John Kander and Fred Ebb, the composers of Cabaret. So, with the Feuer and Martin track record being what it is, Sand must stand a fair chance of being a success. Well, we can only hope that it will be, because the theatre really needs the Feuer and Martin touch.
This book is all that I need. How to succeed.
Money, money.
Michael Craig was the presenter of the Cy Fewer and Ernest Martin story in this week's programme of The American Showman. The writer was Dick Vosborough and the researcher Bill Sullivan. The producer was David Raven Allen. And now Benny Green will add a few words to this evening's programme as well as looking at next week's.
We can bring the Fewer Martin story up to date by confirming the rumours that they went into the Los Angeles and San Francisco Light Opera Association with such enthusiasm that they stayed there for 7 years, producing 5 and sometimes 6 musicals a season, which is the kind of thing that tends to keep a man fairly busy, and 2 men hysterically busy. In between, the pair of them found time to produce a show called The Act, starring Liza Minnelli, and even now as we go to press, they have 2 more interesting chores to chew on. The screen version of the Broadway show Chorus Line, and another show based on the unpublished writings of the film director Preston Sturges, to be called I Belong to Zozo. Fuhr and Martin, on the other hand, would seem to belong to each other. Fuhr was born in 1911, Martin in 1919, so neither of them is ever likely now to get the Most Promising Newcomer award, and yet after a lifetime of work and success, they're still at it. However, both of them are babes in arms compared to next week's subject, the legendary George Abbott. I should imagine that if anybody cared to work it out, George Abbott would be the director, librettist, producer with the best track record of all. Practically everything he ever put his hand to was a hit. And what makes it all doubly awe-inspiring is that a lot of the things that Abbott chose to do were very difficult, as we'll hear. He adapted Shakespeare for the musical stage long before anybody thought of Kiss Me, Kate. He was the first librettist to write a musical incorporating an entire ballet company in the plot. He even adapted a show written by an ancient Roman called Plautus, which came out in the end as a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. But I suppose that the most prodigious feat that George Abbott was involved in was the introduction to the Broadway musical stage of the concept of the anti-hero. Now, the anti-hero had been floating around in novels and straight plays for some time by 1940, but in the musical world, they were still getting the boy to meet the girl next door and keep everything nice and homey. Abbott came along as part of a small group of innovators and changed everything, turned the morality of the musical comedy upside down so successfully that it was never the same again. And one of the finest tributes ever paid to Abbott came from his protege, and a man we'll be hearing from later in this series, Hal Prince.
Abbott was the most important producer, impresario in the American theater. I mean, he started perhaps in the 20s as a star, and then he went from that into directing and writing melodramas. Then he wrote and directed comedies, co-authored. So indeed, he did all those early farces. Three Men on a Horse, Room Service, 20th Century. He almost gave the identity to the American farce. Then he went from that into the musicals with Rodgers and Hart, all the early musicals, including Pal Joey, which was not an early musical, but a watershed musical.
I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simpering, whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep until I could sleep where I shouldn't sleep. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I. Lost my heart, but what of it? My mistake, I agree. He's a laugh, but I love it because the laugh's on me.
Next week we'll get some kind of idea of the range of George Abbott's career, his enormous scope, and his really extraordinary success at the box office. But we'll also find out next week how even a wizard like Abbott makes the occasional mistake. How one day he was called in to perform that nebulous but essential Broadway function, play doctoring. That is, an expert comes in during rehearsals or the out-of-town tryout and does what he can to clean up the mess that everybody else has made. Well, Abbott was called in to doctor a Cole Porter show and decided that his first move must be to drop one of the numbers, which in his opinion was harming the show. It's an endearing mistake for him to have made because it shows that even a superman like George Abbott is human. He is fallible, and he can even laugh later on at his fallibility. Helping to tell the story next week will be performers who work for him like Gwen Verdon and Ray Bolger, Liza Minnelli, and writers like Sheldon Harnick and Richard Rodgers. And most revealing of all, George Abbott himself, the man who one day came into a show rehearsal and dropped this.
From this moment on, you for me, dear, only 2 for tea, dear, from this moment on.